Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, go to www.umm.edu/heart. Speaking of heart, we're joined this hour by Commissioner Fred Bielfeld, who had a rep on the force when he was younger as a man of some heart. I guess he still has it.
a little bit of a segue.
A little bit. Do you like that?
Yeah, it's good. That's a great intro. We're going to have to use that, Anthony.
Yeah. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join our conversation with the police commissioner. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. A lot of you have a lot of thoughts about public safety, about police in your neighborhoods, about issues that you've had, about compliments for the police force as well, about other things you want to have answered. 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. And it seems that you're safe. I mean, the mayor designate has said that you remain, as do the others, the police commissioners, I mean, the fire chief. So this road you've started, and let's talk a bit about that. This road you've started, when I heard you speak recently, you talked about the difficulty and the issues of changing culture. Every department has to change the culture of their department, whether it's education, whether it's the firehouse, or whether it's the police department.
Yeah.
And you talked about the difference between the issue of arrests and making the streets safe, public safety. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think, Mark, that we've, in law enforcement, been caught up in all of these theories and talk about crime prevention and crime modeling and, you know, community policing strategies and intelligence-led policing strategies. And, you know, either I'm too dumb to grasp all that or just too impatient for all of it. And what it seems to me is that we ought to be much more focused on the work of it. And we met today with the head of the Jamaican National Police Force. And we were going over, he was picking my brain, and we were talking about similarities in Jamaica and, you know, the focus on the drug problem and the gang violence and those sorts of things. But I discussed with him, Mark, this notion of the psychology of influencing criminal behavior and not understanding why people commit crime, because, I mean, we could lament that forever. We could study why people do whatever, right? But how do we influence people not to behave in a violent way? Now, you can make an argument that tougher sentences could be a deterrent, right? The same notion about capital punishment and all of those things. But I think that just going and knocking on people's doors and saying, look, we know your buddy got shot last night. We know that you guys have this little gang going over here, but we want to let you know we're paying attention to this. And if you decide to go out with your gun, we have satellites that are watching you. We have your car bugged. We have gun-sniffing dogs and sensors put up all around the house. You might think I'm being facetious, and some people think I'm crazy. Some of my commanders might think that. But to the extent that we can influence people's behavior not to commit violence or interrupt violence, that's where we're going to start making some real inroads. And that's an extreme, right? But think about what we've done with the gun offender registry. People say, okay, it's a registry. People got to go, and after they're convicted, put their name on a list, $1,000 fine, 1 year in jail, big deal, right? But what if the cops really do start understanding the difference in the neighborhoods between a guy that's selling weed on the corner and a guy that's armed virtually every day, all night long, prowling up and down the streets as an enforcer for a Bloods gang in a particular block? You know, in neighborhoods, the East-West Baltimore, they're teaching in the span of the evening, trying to get their kids ready for school or doing the hard things that people do living their lives. They're teaching their kids to dive in bathtubs to take shelter when they hear gunshots and hit the floor, right? And so is it the weed dealer hazarding them, causing them to jump in bathtubs and dive to the floor for cover? It's that guy walking up and down the block with a gun. It's the same reason why the perception about crime in our city, and not just Baltimore, I think in a lot of cities, goes up when the lights go out, right? I mean, the fear goes up when the lights go down. And so I think that there are the same ways that people have this psychology about their fear. I think that we can do much more real work to disrupt violence. And surely we're going to still investigate, right? I mean, it's our duty to do all the forensics and try to figure out who done it. But realizing where we are, we're in a culture in the community where they don't trust police very much for a lot of good reason. The witness intimidation, the retaliatory violence, all of that creates this cauldron where we have to be much more creative than we currently are. And I don't think that gets accomplished by simply putting more cops in a geographic region riding around. I don't think that is simply accomplished by increasing sentencing guidelines, though all of those things help. I think there are much more hands-on specific things we can do to create this violence interruption in our community, and we need to get busy doing that.
But some people have argued, well, it actually was mentioned in the paper the other day, people were trying to advise the mayor designate, the new acting mayor to be, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, what to do, and a former commissioner who now has a radio show said that we should be focusing on crimes that, what's the word I'm looking for? Like prostitution.
Quality of life.
Thank you. Quality of life. We should be panhandling. That's what we should be focusing on.
Well, I've heard those theories before too, Mark. And you know, 2005, we focused very heavily on quality of life enforcement. And I you know, I'm not going to regurgitate that all of that, you know, where we were then, but there was certainly a theory that by making more arrests, you would lower the homicide rate, and we still had nearly 270 homicides in 2005, and we made far fewer arrests because we were prioritizing enforcement, and in 2008, and had a 25-year low. We did the same thing last year. Last year, in 2009, we stayed basically at the same, and we were up by 4. Over where we were the year before. And when I say 4, it's like a lightning bolt in my head. These are 4 lives of 4 people affecting, you know, that had families and had people that care for them. So I don't throw the number out without meaning. So I want people to understand I got the context of it. But, you know, 238 homicides, again, 20-year lows, right? We made 3,000 fewer adult arrests last year, Mark. We arrested 1,000 fewer juveniles last year. And I know we're going to talk later much more in depth about juvenile issues. But again, it gets back to you have to define your focus. And you can't just indiscriminately police communities. You have to partner and police with neighborhoods. And we're only – I'll tell you, Mark, the biggest degree of satisfaction I have about, you know, the endorsement of our strategy is that we get to continue it and give it a real chance to move forward. These things take a while to start changing a police organization and changing a culture away from this incessant focus about drugs into who's causing violence. I mean, that's the way you get community support, because people are fearful. They're fearful in their community about these guys running around. They're just as likely to get shot or robbed or raped or brutalized, even in their daily life. Even if they're not wielding guns, they're intimidated by these thugs in their neighborhoods, and they want the cops to do something about that. They want their government, their society to do something. And when they don't, they either wind up fearful and cowering in their houses, or they push back. And it just becomes this incredibly vicious cycle that we need to take a much more active role in. And so I aim to continue to challenge convention and to continue developing ideas and strategies that help us prevent crime. And I get the whole focus about drinking and loitering, but I know that it takes my cops away from the bigger mission right now, and 234 or 238 is still no victory in Baltimore. And when the people say, hey, that's great, a 20-year low, and that's good, it should pretend that we're headed in the right direction, but still per capita, it's enormous, the violence levels in Baltimore. So nobody, least of all police in this city, should be claiming a victory in terms of where we are and where we want to be in violence levels of our city.
One of the things that, talking about violence, I mean, this city, and I encourage our listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888. To join in this conversation with Commissioner Bielefeld, bring your concerns to the table, whether you're a community member, whether you're a police officer, concerned citizen, someone who has had interaction with the police, your thoughts on policing and violence in this town. We want to hear what you have to say at 410-319-8888. But one of the things, and I was trying to pull the stats up here, but let me stop playing with the computer and we can pull them up later, is that this is still a very violent city.
Yeah, sure.
Murders may be fairly level to where they were last year, and at a low time and a low for the last 10, 20 years.
Non-fatal shootings down incredibly, almost 25% down. It's incredible work that these men and women are doing.
The stat I wanted to pull up that I don't have in front of me, which I'll pull up in a minute, and maybe you have it in your head, are the number of robberies.
Yeah. Down 11%, but still high.
And aggravated assaults.
Yeah. Down in both. Down in both,
but still,
Mark,
huge
but
numbers.
Still high.
Huge numbers.
Still high. You know, part one crime in our city is still over 40,000 a year. Part one crime.
What does that
reported.
Mean? What's a part one crime?
Well, it's like burglary, stolen auto. It's the compilation of all the serious crimes: aggravated assaults, robbery, rape, stolen auto, larceny, and burglary all go into the part one, and certainly the homicide number all go into the part one crime compilation. And so it's still high. We're making incredible, Mark, you know, I'm looking at 3-year averages now, 5-year averages. We're making incredible progress, but no one should declare victory. And certainly none of my partners, none of the partners that I work with closely, and none of the cops that I'm keeping around think that by any means it's that we're at the end or, you know, we've done something extraordinary. I think it's a good tiny baby step in the right direction.
We have a number of callers calling in. But the number I was trying to find, when the next caller calls, I'll pull it up on my computer. But in 2008, there were over 4,000, slightly over 4,000 robberies.
Yeah, I have the
right?
numbers. I mean, I tell you specifically
huge number of robberies in a city like ours. I mean, because that is not, you know, people say everything's in the inner city, blah, blah, blah. Robberies are everywhere.
Yeah, I think we probably finished, and I have the numbers probably through the mid part of December. I apologize for not having all of them, but we probably finished the year around 3,800 robberies, and compared to in 2008, we had about 4,500. So we are down considerably, down 11% in robberies, and it's great work. And we've developed internally inside our lane, Mark, we've developed some great stuff. This isn't just like, well, you know, it's trending that way. We put some really serious work in there with some great partners. We've invested in technology. We've invested in good detective work. Our targeting is getting better. We've prioritized warrant service around gun offenders, and most of them are robbers. You know, these guys that are out doing stick-ups, you know, they'll just as soon rob a drug dealer on a corner for his stash and his cash as he will, you know, some lady that just got her check cashed. And so prioritizing robberies, you know, by way of enforcement has yielded some great results for us. But, again, you bring it out. I mean, we have a long way to go.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. I'll write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Our guest is Commissioner Fred Bielefeld, of course, Commissioner of the Police here in Baltimore City. And Bruce in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Commissioner, I don't know you personally, and I generally should give you the benefit of the doubt, but I'm kind of critical, and a lot of people I know that are really cynical, that don't trust the police department. Mm-hmm. One of the main things I'm concerned with, I'm not saying it's an easy job, And I know I want to see you get the bad guys off the street, but a lot of times the citizens, sometimes they don't want to get involved because they had some really negative experiences with the police department. If I had a half an hour, some of the stuff that I've seen police officers do is absolutely unprofessional, indifferent, immature. They're like junior high kids sometimes. And I know all the police officers aren't like that. I've met some ones, police officers that are really decent. But it seems to me like there's a culture in the police department. And there's nothing wrong with some public relations, but what really has to be done, that people at the top have to realize the culture in the police department has to change in certain ways, and it's oversight. Well, we have to have a better civilian review board, a review board that has the power to get information, that has the power to not recommend for the police commissioner, but to force them to make changes. When there's behavior problems with the police department, it has to be taken seriously.
All right, Bruce, let me let the commissioner respond.
Yeah, okay, so first let me tell you something, say that, I grew up in a police family, and so I know the fleas of police as well as anybody. And I will tell you, I've known some really bad people that were cops, and I've known some of the most heroic people that ever walked the planet Earth were cops. And but we could talk about that anecdotally all you want, but what are you doing about it? I mean, people should ask me, Bielfeld, what are you doing about it? So I'll tell you what I'm doing about it. In the last 2.5 years, I've driven my staff crazy around one big notion. You know what it is? It's training. Because I think if you're going to develop a professional anything, whether it's a snowball stand, an auto dealership, or a police force, you ought to give them the very best training you can. And it ought to be around a lot of issues. If you want your cops to be able to interact better with kids, then train them with kids. We've invested, Mark, in the last 2.5 years, over $2 million in the face of the worst economic times, I don't know, in my lifetime, certainly in my professional lifetime, over $2 million. You know where I'm getting it from? Drug dealer asset money. And a lot of people are critical of that. They say,
what does that mean, drug dealer asset money?
Yeah, asset forfeiture. So when we arrest drug dealers and are convicted and we've seized their bank accounts or their cash, when we seize their money, it gets through federal asset sharing, a portion of that comes back to the local jurisdictions. And we've taken that and we've invested it in better training for our cops. And it's not just about how to operate computers. Remember where we were 2.5 years ago, Mark. When I took over this job, people were talking about the huge number of police-involved shootings. And the police-involved shootings have leveled off. You know what most of our police-involved shootings were about 2.5 years ago? You know what they were about? I know what they were about.
What were they about?
Struggles over the officer's weapon. The officer took their weapon out, and the suspect and the officer were struggling for control, and the officer shot him. And so I, right out of the box, I said, we got to train our guys better. There's a way to avoid that if we train them better arrest and control tactics. There's a better way to reach juveniles if we get cops really working with kids, really working with kids in constructive ways. And I think that you don't teach cultural diversity by way of an hour-long session so you placate the community and get some cheap cover on it. It's BS. The way to get cultural diversity is put cops in neighborhoods and have them walk footpost in neighborhoods where they're unaccustomed or they haven't had a real dialogue in communicating with people.
We have a lot of people calling in, so I want to get the phones. Just a quick question. When we first talked, as you first became acting commissioner,
yeah,
before you became commissioner, you talked a lot about the idea of foot patrols and how important that was, getting
yeah,
police out of their cars.
Yeah.
How real is that now? How much is that really changed?
Well, I'm investing. You know, again, the federal government comes knocking on our door and says, hey, you know, they have this cops grant. What do you want to do with them? And I know there are a lot of people all over the country that are putting cops in radio cars and driving them around. We want to take our cops money and the positions we hired to put more cops on foot walking on a permanent basis. That's what we want to use our money for. When, I catch the heat about the pocket cop, right? that's the mobile device that clips on their belt. And why? Why did I buy a device, Mark, that clips on their belt and not clip on the dashboard of the radio car? Oh, the cops want you to have computers in the radio car to do the some of the stuff that this guy's complaining about. They want to watch DVDs, and they want to, you know, some want to be able to work from inside the car. It's a mobile office. I want cops outside of cars. So I'm willing to commit, you know, nearly $4 million of your stimulus money to strategies that get cops really out of cars and walk in neighborhoods. And so I'm committed to that. I mean, I can't take credit for that. I mean, a lot of people have paved the way to do that. Commissioner Hamm was very passionate about it. And I've tried to continue it because I think that you can't police neighborhoods separated by glass and steel at 30 miles an hour or 40 miles an hour driving around talking on your cell phone.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say at 410-319-8888. It's going to go Chris, Steve, and Joe in that order, so hold on. We're going to get to all your calls that are coming in. And Chris, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hello. My name is Chris Taylor. I was on your show last month, Mark,
right.
And I'm sure, Bielfeld, you obviously know that I was arrested by two of your officers in front of my own home for doing absolutely nothing. And then you yourself and your spokesperson declared me guilty before there was any even due process. Now I have to actually go to court for disturbing the peace. I mean, it's an unbelievable process. And I don't understand how you can sit here on this radio show and talk about all these supposed things that you've done, and you've never even once talked about the massive social effect of your policies, of your zero-tolerance policies. 87,000-some-odd people arrested every year, a huge prison population, no men in these homes, no available jobs, no ability for these people to recourse because your IED is completely phony. I mean, Sergeant May sat in my own home and told me directly that I was guilty before he even started the process. So, I mean, have you ever even once considered the massive social cost of a zero-tolerance police policy? And either we have thousands of delusional people out here who are claiming they've been locked up, beaten, and abused by police, or there's a serious problem in your department that you're unwilling or unable to confront, including Mr. Clay, who lives in our neighborhood, who had his arm broken in two places, 73 years old.
Are you done? And so I would urge you, Mr. Taylor, to infuse your remarks with facts. And the facts are that over the last 2.5 years, we have made fewer and fewer arrests than any police commissioner in the last 5 years. Released without charges are going down. You know, this supposed zero tolerance strategy that you reference is you can't cite a single instance where I've advocated for that strategy. In fact, I've worked to the chagrin of many, many people trying to break down that culture. And so as it relates to your personal case, it is a pending legal matter, and I wouldn't comment further.
Well, listen, without getting into that issue at the moment, because Chris was on the show, and we had a long conversation about that, and I want to go to the phone banks are getting filled, and a lot of people are calling in. But let me talk about that. I mean, let's take – now, I wasn't there what happened when Lenny Clay was arrested, but I know Lenny. I've known Lenny for 38 years. I used to get my haircut at Lenny's shop. I don't know what happened at that moment. I know that Lenny is considered one of the great elders of his community and does a huge amount to cut crime in that town and in that part of the Southwest Side. The kids know him. They love him. They respect him. He gets in the middle of things. He's an amazing human being. But the issue, the larger issue, because I don't expect you to speak to that incident directly until it's resolved, but there is an issue with, as one police officer told me just a little bit ago, as I've heard of twice in the last couple of weeks, is that we are taught not to have interactions with citizens as if we're on an equal plane, not to get engaged in these conversations and to be separate from that.
I don't know. These guys must be from Venus, frankly. And I wish I had names associated with these guys because that's certainly not the work. All you have to do is go and spend time with the teaching. Go see what's going on at the police academy. Go and see what's happening in the Diamond Standard training. It's unparalleled in this country. I mean, people don't, you know, we're not talking about, you know, where we recruit and go to city middle schools and recruit the classes to come and work out with veteran police and spend days with veteran police at Outward Bound and training programs that are unprecedented in our police department. The investment in the resources in our IID, look, we have a long way to go between the trust. No one's going to – you won't get an argument from me that there is enormous deficiencies in trust. What Chris Taylor's not telling you is he had Scott Bloodsworth's personal cell phone number. His personal cell phone number, Mark. You know, you can't say we don't have relationships with cops and the district commanders are I don't know how much more you could ask district commanders to do. They're available to the people they serve 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And for anybody to say Scott Bloodsworth in that district, I stand behind that man. Because that man takes calls at the hazard of his family and his personal life to put the citizens in the community of South Baltimore first. And he does an outstanding job, as do Mark, the vast majority of our cops. Where we have corruption, yes, we always should challenge ourselves. We should always challenge ourselves to do better. I had Keith Matthews and Nate Warfield in my office just yesterday. And what I keep saying to those guys and, frankly, challenging their picks for the people who want to go there. You know what my goal is? To build the strongest IID we've ever had in the history of the police department.
IID being internal investigation.
Yeah, internal affairs. And I see the picks they want to take there. And you know, we have some very pointed discussions about why this person or why that, what strengths they bring. And so, you know, you have to deal with the facts. And to say that the police department's engaged in this war on the citizenry, it just can't – nothing could be further from the truth. We want to break down those barriers.
I want to promise my listeners here there's like five callers waiting.
Yeah, sure.
And we're going to get to all of you. We're going to take a short break. Joe in Reservoir Hill, you are the next caller up. We're going to come right to a call when we return. And after that, Mark in Baltimore, the next caller up. We have Green in Howard County. 410-319-8888. We'll get to all those calls in a row, I promise, as soon as we return, as we talk with Baltimore City Police Commissioner Frederick Bielfeld. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking with Commissioner Fred Bielfeld, of course, Police Commissioner of Baltimore City. We've just been joined by Donald DeVore, who is the head of DJS here in the state of DJS. I always forget which way they call
Department
it.
Department of Juvenile Services.
Just making sure. And he'll be joining us in just a minute to talk about the collaboration going on between the police department and the juvenile services system. 410-319-8888's number. Before we go to Joe in Reservoir Hill, I'm going to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community to prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its 7 branches or go to mecu.com for more information. The number here is 410-319-8888. Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark. I hope you guys can hear me clearly.
We can. Thanks for joining us.
I moved into Reservoir Hill about 3 or so years ago. I bought my family there, and I have to tell you, initially moving in, I was frightened to death. Literally, when I came out the front door of my house, there were drug dealers standing on the street that faces my house. And I have to tell you, in the last 3 years, I've seen foot patrols. The police have been extremely responsive to us, you know, and really, I think the foot patrols have made a difference. I think they've done targeted enforcement. But what I would ask the commissioner to do is, we see the tags coming in for Pennsylvania. We see the folks coming in off of I-83, pulling in through our neighborhood. I mean, they stick out like sore thumbs buying the drugs. And there are numerous homes there. The Reservoir Hill has come a long way. Whitelock used to be a pretty bad street, and it still has issues. But I really want to thank them. I just wish we could get more and consistent foot patrols and better, you know, just targeted enforcement with some of the activity that's going on there. And I'll listen for your response. But I've seen a difference, and thank you.
Yeah, I first of all, I appreciate that. The men and women in the Central District deserve a lot of credit. But I would urge you on a couple fronts. One is that Father Tom from the Catholic Church up there runs a COP walk up around the Druid Hill, White Lock, Callow Avenue area. And the first couple times I've been on that walk, there were some folks, Mark, that from the local, I guess, halfway house actually came out. We saw these guys pull up in the van the first time. It was kind of weirded me out. And all these guys jumped out of the van and, you know, ex-offenders. And they joined us on the walk. I mean, we weren't singing Kumbaya, but I thought it was.
Well, why not?
Well, I don't know all the words, and I don't think they were up to it. But I thought it was. I thought it was a fantastic partnership that the community has sown. That's one, because I think that there is a lot of street level activity that we can do better on. The second part is that there are some creative solutions working through your community neighborhood association on the prostitution model that I think that we could take better use of on the drug side, and that is the John's letters. And some folks, my experience down in South Baltimore, where prostitution was pretty pervasive, and you know, where cars are pulling up and that sort of thing, the community got together and partnered with the district in mailing out those letters saying, hey, nothing for nothing, but we saw your tag down here in a notorious area for prostitution. We hope you're not engaged in that activity. We just, in case someone else was driving your car, we want to make you aware of that. And so, again, it's very creative. And these folks are driving in from Catonsville and York County, Pennsylvania, and coming into these areas. And I think that beyond just arresting, I think there are many, many ways to skin this cat.
I mean, there's one of the things we will talk about with the governor tomorrow morning is just how we invest our state funds and whether it makes sense to invest state funds in constantly arresting prostitutes and low-level dealers and putting them in jail for 6 months or 6 years, as opposed to what seems to be working in every other place in America that tries it, which is doing outside of prison services where the recidivism rate becomes even lower. Yeah. Because, I mean, I'm not getting to that, but it just is always bugs me, the whole idea of arresting prostitutes, mm-hmm. and then the Johns walk free, and you know it is the way we've done things for a long time.
Well, you know, listen, you and I could have like a philosophical discussion on it.
I'm trying to be pragmatic. That's but
I got you. But we could have that, Mark. But right now, that discussion and those ideas are impacted by the dire financial situation that the state is in, because, as the secretary will affirm, a lot of these things, a lot of these programs are among the first on the budget chopping block. And that's not a question of the governor's will or his commitment to public safety, because he's done extraordinary things at the state level to get state government involved in partnering to make Baltimore safer. There are unprecedented things. But things like drug treatment dollars suffer. Things like ex-offender job training programs suffer. Community mediation programs, Mark, suffer. You know all this. And they suffer in these budget times.
Well, and that'll be Griffith Mill for tomorrow morning, but that's when we meet the governor. 410-319-8888. Let's see. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, Commissioner and Mr. Mark Steiner. How are you?
Welcome.
Okay, sir.
Yes, I'd just like to tell you a little bit about myself before I start. I'm an ex-offender. I've been free from the legal system over 20 years. I've been free from drugs now about 15 years. And I have the utmost respect for what you and the officers of Baltimore City are doing. I just need to stress that from where I stand and from where I sit and have sat, one of the main things that's fueling the crime in Baltimore is the drug trade. It takes an enormous amount of money for just one individual to keep a drug habit going. I'm talking about heroin addiction. I'm a substance abuse counselor now. It takes a lot of money, and that money is not coming from legal sources. It's coming from people robbing me, you, or anybody else they get an opportunity to. And one of the things that really is bothering me at this point is the Avenue Market in West Baltimore. There, it seems like the sale of heroin and anything else you want to buy is legal there. I see it every time I'm there. I'm not saying the officers turn a blind eye to it, but maybe someone could give it a little more attention for the citizens there who would like to frequent that market but are now scared to do so because of the illegal activity that goes on there. Again, I think you guys are doing a fine job. As a matter of fact, Commissioner, my wife and I took a photograph of you the 4th of July at the Inner Harbor. I would like to hear your response to what you would like to do for the Avenue Market, and I'll listen to it off the air.
I think there's a couple parts here. One is that I think that I'd rather be in the business of arresting fewer people that are addicted to drugs and figuring out alternatives to tying up very valuable police resources and government resources on that aspect. So if I'd like to hear more about what worked in your life to change your addiction. And so I think that those are the things we should be listening to. As it relates to drug dealing and its effect on the community and business areas, I think that we play a very big role in that. And that Pennsylvania Avenue corridor, you know, has historic ramifications. And, you don't need me to educate you about what Pennsylvania Avenue signifies in terms of the drug trade or the business community. You know, at one time, Pennsylvania Avenue was the landmark of the African-American entertainment scene, not just in Baltimore, but arguably in the country. In the clubs and the shows that and the theaters that were along that stretch, and now we're just battling every day with an open air culture to try to eradicate that and limit the violence along there, Mark, so that people can get back in there and establish real businesses and revitalize that area.
I'm going to bring Don DeVore in here now. Before we turn to Green and Howard County, Anna and Manny, we're going to get your calls as well and let you be part of this program. And I think before we do that, there's always this contradiction in the streets between people who don't want to see low-level drug crimes end up busted and spending their time at the detention center languishing in jail. On the other hand,
I think you have to be strategic.
Hand, they want you to come in and clean the corners so folks can be safe. It's a really difficult, it's a tightrope.
Yeah, because you shouldn't just do it everywhere. You shouldn't have, as other people say, you shouldn't have this one-size-fits-all strategy. And I think that where there are specific problems, you ought to have specific strategies for dealing with that. And our specific strategy along Pennsylvania Avenue is the first priority is to reduce violent crime. And the second priority is to winnow down that open-air drug trafficking however we can.
So, Secretary DeVore, welcome. Good to have you with us in the studio as well.
Thanks so much.
Always
really
good to see you.
To be here, Mark. Yeah, I really am.
So now, tell me why you're here.
Well,
because he's a great partner to the BPD. Well,
talk about that for a minute.
Well, first of all, because I'm part of the Admiration Society of Commissioner Bielefeld.
Please. But
what I'm really here to talk about is when I was with you 4 months ago or so, I told you I thought that we were going to have some pretty good numbers at the end of the year that were impressive about some very targeting type of work that we've been doing in the city. And I'm really pleased to tell you, and I know the governor will make it part of his address and the State of the State address, that this past year we experienced a 55% reduction in juvenile homicides in the city. That means that this year there'll be 14 more children who will be able to live their lives, hopefully, through adulthood than they were able to last year. But we've also seen a very significant reduction in non-fatal shootings. We've seen a significant reduction in number of juveniles that have been identified as shooters. And all of this is as a result of a different approach that we have taken with our partners at the police department and at the health department in looking at kids that we think that are most likely to shoot somebody or most likely to be shot. And as I told you last time I was here, my experience of 35 years, and I think Commissioner will say this too, there's an extremely fine line between kids that shoot somebody and kids that get shot. And so what we've done with the police department is we've challenged some really traditional notions about how police departments and juvenile service agencies can work together. And just a couple of very fast examples, because I know you're short on time. The first one is that confidentiality. Confidentiality, since the juvenile court was established in 1899, has served a purpose. But it also, in my opinion, has served as a barrier to working effectively with partners that have just a great or even a greater interest in public safety than we do. And so the first thing that I did when I got here with the commissioner was establish an MOU to allow us to share information back and forth.
An MOU being?
A memorandum of understanding about how we could share information and make sure that provisions of confidentiality are still protected. We placed our juvenile workers right in the watch center, shoulder to shoulder, with police officers in their command center to be able to share information. We developed together a new risk assessment instrument to identify the 300 youth who we knew in the city who represented the greatest risk. And then we did something that I know you and I talked about and that you very much favored. It's not enough to simply watch those kids and to enforce the provisions of the court. You also have to provide services if you expect them to change. So we went to our partners in the city through the health department and Operation Safe Kids, which was originally started when the governor was mayor, and we expanded that to include to make sure that every one of our kids that were identified as that high-risk category were receiving intensive services. We started working with the schools, you know, we talked about that before, getting truancy data every day, getting a dump so we could check and make sure that our kids were school. Very importantly, we worked with the police department in serving warrants. You know, so frequently I would have a kid that what I would say goes bad, right? He's on probation, he's doing well. He has a breakup with a girlfriend or, you know, has a domestic problem at home with his parents or whatever it might be. And you know that this kid is really going to get into something that's not good for any of us. Once you learn that that youth's not going to school or not obeying, it's very important to get a warrant issued. Prior to our working together, as you know, hundreds and thousands of warrants sat dormant without any action being taken on them. So what we did, got together with the police department, said, let's prioritize these warrants. Let's look at the kids who are most likely to be the shooters or to get shot. Let's make sure that we're out there that day getting those kids, pulling them back in with our staff. Safety plans. I heard the commissioner talking about, looking at retaliatory violence. We know there's retaliatory violence. And developing safety plans for other family members that are in a family where there's been a shooting and working together, curfew checks and a lot of other things. But I think all of those have contributed to this year. If you look and you compare us, for instance, to 1999, going back 8 years, there were 31 juvenile homicides in the city. We had not that it's, I shouldn't say just, but we had 14 this past year.
So what happens to these kids that you pick up between the police department and DJS? Where do the kids go?
Well, the first thing that happens, of course, is that we have specially trained workers that work with the police department. They're called our Violence Prevention Initiative workers. These are some of our top people. And this is not a gotcha kind of thing. This is to make sure that kids are staying lined up with the service plans that have been developed for them. And our greatest interest is to make sure that these kids, stay safe. So there's not a, sort of like a uniform response to every kid. It's different for every kid. And depending on what the circumstances and the behavior is, if they're involved in dangerous behavior, they're going to be picked up and they're going to be detained. If they're kids that are simply experiencing bumps in the road, and that's what a lot of our kids do, they experience they fall down, they have to get back up. And, if it's that kind of thing, then our workers are going to work with them and adjust their service plans to make sure that it's more responsive to what their needs are. These same kids, you did a program here about 6 months ago on evidence-based practice models.
Right, like MST, multi-systemic therapy.
Right, exactly. And we've expanded those enormously, so these kids are also able to avail themselves of those services as well.
Now, I wish I could ask more questions about that, but we don't want to spend too much time on that. But part of our show tomorrow will be talking to the governor about multi-systemic services and the recidivism rate and how low it is, mm-hmm. and why not let Don DeVore turn the entire system on his head so that becomes the major way we deal with kids as opposed to locking them up for all the money.
A thousand fewer arrests. We've done all this, Mark. And we made 1,000 fewer juvenile arrests this year compared to even last. I think it's an endorsement, Secretary, of our strategy mm-hmm. and how we prioritize our resources.
I mean, it's unprecedented to me to hear about a police department working hands in glove with juvenile services.
It hasn't happened in this state before.
It's never happened in this state. No, because someone has been yelling about it for a long time.
Yeah.
This has never happened in this state before where these agencies have worked together to actually not just arrest kids,
right.
but to turn them around so they come back to do living lives not of crime.
Well, the key is prevention, right? I mean, we want to prevent. We want to prevent kids from being victims. We want to prevent kids from getting involved in criminal activity. And I'm not using my cops to be social workers. We've engaged in our right contribution, and the secretary has the right people on his end, and it's just a win-win partnership for both of us.
Let me open the phones to our listeners back in this. We're also joined besides you here, Fred Bielfeld, our commissioner of police here in Baltimore City, Don DeVore, who is secretary of juvenile services here in the state of Maryland, talking about a partnership they formed, which is fairly unique. Maybe not in the country. It's not going on very many places in the country, but it certainly has never happened here in Baltimore City. 410-319-8888, Green in Howard County. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Steiner and commissioner and your other guests.
Good evening.
You know, I could challenge your explanation of police-involved killings by mentioning names like Jamie Quarles or Joe Washington or Mr. Hubbard, but I won't do that. Instead, I think I'd like to commend you on the police department finally realizing the value of what Delegate Carter was saying back in 2004, 2005, 2006. That solving crime in Baltimore City wasn't a matter of just locking up people at random, but having less arrests, but arresting the right people. We saw crime going up during those years, and like you said, 2005, you made less arrests. The gentleman just speaking said that you had a more targeted policy, and crime has gone down. But what I'd really like to say, and I think you mentioned it, crime is a problem that's systemic. It comes from a variety of reasons. One is the fact that the education system doesn't offer children a relevant education, so that they don't feel their value is in being a criminal, rather in their academic excellence. Also, the thing I'd like to also say, you mentioned drug problem. With a lack of jobs in Baltimore City, 50% unemployment for young black men, and a high, although less, rate for adult black men, and the high prevalence of drugs that are available, I know it's not your job to be educators. It's not your job to, your job is policing. So in the sense of policing, I like to call attention to the 1995 investigative grand jury report commissioned by Judge Kenneth Johnson, in which the conclusion of the grand jury was that there would be no drug trade in Baltimore City without the collusion of the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office and the Baltimore City Police. You know, the concentration is on low-level drug dealers rather than the people who make the big money on drugs, who import
So Green, only in the interest of time, because we're running close to the top of the hour, if you could wrap that up so that you can have a response.
Well, that was it. I'd like to get his response.
Well, okay. I will give you a very quick response, and I think that we do play a role to an extent. And in I'll give you one example. I think that these notions that people keep talking about, this zero tolerance, which I abhor. And I think we play a role by policing strategies in affecting people's lives, and especially young black men's lives in this city. And if we were if I were to endorse or for anyone to endorse these kinds of strict enforcement strategies that create criminal records for young men right at the beginning of their lives that really affect whether they stay in school or not or whether they have a chance to succeed in employment, we do play a role in that. And so when you encourage that kind of activity, you do have a hand in that the economic dynamic of the community, which cannot be ignored. And I realize that as much as anyone else. The other thing I would say, though, is that we need to be careful to stay in the lanes that we can affect. I'm responsible for public safety in the city, and so Secretary DeVore is responsible for DJS, and Secretary Maynard's responsible for state public safety. And so people stay in their lanes, and we get contributions, and we work together. We can make change, and I think there are people in the state's attorney's office, the U.S. attorney's office, and we have a chance here, Mark. What Baltimore, I hope they take from this conversation and the many more we have as we progress along, we have the ingredients to take public safety in Baltimore to an incredibly new level with very, very potentially great results for the city.
I wish we had more time because we have all these callers calling in, Annie, Manny, and Gregory all calling in to kind of compliment and thank the commissioner. Let's let you know that those are coming through. Harold and others have questions about what needs to be done about crime, which only leads me to say that we invite Commissioner Bielefeld to be here as much as he can afford to be here to talk to the citizens of Baltimore. It's always welcome to have you on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
And Secretary DeVore, always good to have you on the air. We'll have you back again as well to talk
appreciate
more about what's
being
going
here.
On.
Thanks
always
very
good to
much,
see
Mark.
You. Yep. And folks, thank you all for calling in and writing in and making the show what it is. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. It's not too late to join us to come down to the Annapolis Summit tomorrow morning with the governor at 7:30 at St. John's College. Go on to the Mark Steiner Show website, and you can just find out how easy it is to get there. Don't worry about the money. Just come down and be part of the conversation with the governor tomorrow morning. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Marianne Amos. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and hear new additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.